Cast Hey everyone, welcome back to Reptile Ramblings. As always, I'm your host Nate. Brian will be hopping on here shortly. Hopefully he manages to get home alive. Hopefully, fingers crossed. But while we're waiting for him to go, come on, we'll go ahead and do our sponsorships. So, as always, we're sponsored by Serpentine Expeditions. So that's Ian Breland's herp booking, herp tour company. So if you look on their webpage you have up here, let's see if I can get it up. Yep. All right. Yeah, I see all sorts of stuff. Probably should have gone to the actual expeditions they have coming up. Last time I checked, I think it was Ecuador was the only one that they had left. Let's see here. But if you do decide to go through them, where you're good to check out, there should be a slot for. Oh yeah, see, Ecuador still open, and sorry, not sold out, but they still have slots open for Ecuador for April, mid-April of 2026, and that's an 11-day trip. So if you want to see some cool stuff, Amazon, kind of the capital of the world for going to see Amazonian stuff outside of maybe Brazil or Peru. So yeah, use code CK25 at checkout if you go through them, and you get $100 off your booking, which, hey, $100 is $100. That goes a long way. That's might be able to get you dinner and a tank of gas. So. But yeah, please feel free to use them, and make sure to use the discount code to check out. All right, now that that's out of the way, I guess I'll introduce our guest. So tonight I am joined by Aaron of Woods and Streams Media and the organizer behind Frog Week. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to being here for the first time and just talking about a lot of this project with you.
Yeah, excited to have you on. So, you want to get us started off on how you first got into amphibians?
Yeah. So, as I was growing up in our backyard, the nonprofit that I'm representing is PA Woods and Forests, and that's where I grew up as well. In our backyard, we had a lot of different frogs and toads. Always making their way somehow into our yard, and as a kid, we just thought it was always interesting. But I never really was fascinated enough to want to build tanks or to want to get into researching them. It was just something that they came to our yard and passed us by, and it is what it is at that point. But it wasn't until probably my sophomore year in high school, junior year in high school, we went on some trips to Charlotte, and I had a chance to go out, and we were just experiencing these different state parks, and it was a really special trip where I started thinking, well, this is actually really neat seeing all the little frogs and toads, and I wanted to like potentially have a terrarium, and it started getting me thinking about maybe I could create something or I could do something that I would enjoy. So I started reading about it and wanted to make a decision. Did I want to pick southeastern animals, or did I want to pick northeastern animals since I was from Pennsylvania? That was still something important to me. And I spent the whole winter just kind of researching, thinking what I wanted to do. I ended up catching a toad later in that spring, and that kind of made the decision for me. But I wasn't really involved in the culture at all with keeping them or anything like that. I started after I had caught that toad, I started to get deeper into it, but that toad ended up becoming very sick, and I was not aware at the time. I was, again, a high school kid, and I had no idea about like parasites and disease and different things that the wild frogs and toads will face. So I ended up trying to take that toad to the different vets in the area. Nobody could help her, and then I ended up calling the Pittsburgh Zoo. The Pittsburgh Zoo gave me a list of vets who I could call. I ended up calling somebody who was not listed, but she ended up saving my toad. And it was such a roller coaster of emotion going through that. Hey, what's up?
Hey, Ramblers, and what's up? What's up, guys? Hey, Aaron, right? Hey,
yes, man. Yes, sir. Thank you. I was just in the middle of talking about how all this came to be, so you came in at the right time. It started to get interesting, so you know, you made a good appearance here.
I try to be as perfect with my time as I
you keep muting yourself, seems like.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's kind of hectic at the moment, my surroundings. But where are we at, chaps? Have you done our sponsors already?
Yep, right? Did the sponsors, did the intro spiel, got them starting on how we got into Amphibians. So.
Yeah, because I did take a gander at your Insta, Aaron, and yeah, you seem to be more of the Amphibian guy. Obviously, I'm pretty sure you have no hate on reptiles, but how did that come to be?
Yeah, so long story short, I wasn't somebody who grew up and wanted to get into keeping reptiles and amphibians. It wasn't until later in high school where I had caught a toad, and then that toad ended up getting sick, and it was pretty much like a Hail Mary life or death decision. It was like a couple of days until she was going to be put down in my hometown. I went to a vet in Pittsburgh that ended up like doing different surgeries and saved her life. And I made the decision that I wasn't going to allow that to happen again. And I just wanted to make an impact on the native species. Like, it just clicked in my mind that what I experienced, how personable that toad was, how much it impacted me. I wasn't going to let something like that happen out of ignorance. I wasn't going to be foolish about things. So I just went the whole way in. And I even, to be honest with you, when I went into college, did not plan on going for herpetology at all. It wasn't until maybe 4 years in, I was in my undergrad, and I already was pursuing a communication degree, but it started to come together where not only was I influenced by what I was seeing at home, but I wanted to make an impact outside as well. And I started thinking about creating a nonprofit, and I started running that past some of the professors, and I worked in land trusts and conservation districts, and I was an intern in a lot of different places. And there were a lot of experts in the field that said, well, you're not working in exotic frogs, you're not working with the venomous snakes or the largest salamander in the state, so you're gonna have a hard time getting it funded and getting people to pay attention. A lot of people said it wasn't going to take off, wouldn't be interesting, nobody would care. And I heard all that criticism, and I'm not somebody that gets motivated by, you know, if you insult me, I feel sorry for you that's how you feel, but like, I operate a different way. I just, it doesn't motivate me one way or the other. I just feel bad that's how you felt. But like, anyway, I just say that because then, like, I was still willing to bet on myself and bet on the project. And in 2019, I made the decision that I was going to start a conservation project, and I wasn't sure what to call it. And I was huge into like watching Animal Planet and National Geographic, BBC America, even like Steve Irwin. That was big inspiration. And I didn't know what, it's kind of funny, right? Because I'm a communication major, but like, I'm like, oh, struggling for a name for months. And then I came up with the name Frog Week. It was just like, you know what? Why not? Because it makes people think about it. And I think it gets the point across. Now I see it. I don't want it to come across as like arrogant or disrespectful. I'm not taking away from other projects, or I'm not saying this is the only thing, because obviously there's some exotic frogs and there's other frogs in the country and around the world that are also deserving of their own conservation projects. But it just kind of stayed with the project, and I never really wanted to change the name since we ran with it from the beginning. I'll give you a funny story. As this was starting up, I went to a reptile expo, and Josh's Frogs happened to be there. And I started talking to the one guy who was in their like marketing team, and we had such a good conversation. We stayed in touch. I got his number after, and we're talking, and I wanted to go up to Michigan to visit them, because like, as I was in the culture now, I started to realize like how big Josh's Frogs was at the time. And I don't exactly know how it happened, but it was the winter before we did the conservation project for the first year. I went up to Josh's Frogs, and I think they thought I was his nephew. So when I got there, they were so excited to see me. They're like, oh, like Michael never has anybody join him. Like, there's nobody from his family that we ever get to meet. We're so happy to meet you. I just like let it keep going. I didn't say anything. And then whenever I saw him, I shook his hand, and I like got in his ear. I was like, you realize they think I'm your nephew? And he was like, Yeah. And I was just like, and eventually we broke it to them. But it was such a great experience too, because like they had this pizza party and like there's all these people, like these big, they had like all the departments there. So there's probably like, I don't know, 50 to 100 people. And I didn't expect this, but they just like gave me the floor to like talk about why I was there. And I just stood up and gave this speech. And then they showed me around, but I made so many close friends there that it stuck. And then they wanted to participate. They believed in what I was going to do before I even started the project. And since then, like if you go on Instagram, if you look on Facebook, whatever, Josh's Frogs to this day has still been supporting the project with their media. It's almost like a Frog Week takeover where like they're posting the shorts, we're collaborating together. Like there's so much that they've done for the project. So I just wanted to give them a shout out. I know that a lot of people might be getting their feeders from them or getting like different vivarium substrate or lights, and it's legit. So I just wanted to give them their flowers, because like this whole week they've been even more impressive with how they've been focusing on the project. But yeah, so it's been a roller coaster ride. We're in year 7, and we've appeared in seven years we've appeared in all 67 counties in multiple states. I've done TV, I've done radio, I've been on the cover of newspapers. So it's really special. And I like to kind of compare this to maybe an athlete or a musician. You know, like let's say like an athlete, you know, they win the national championship or they win the big game. It's like how many people, you know, you think about like milestones, like you're one, like for us, you're 1, you're 5, you're 10, 25, like that's when you're going to get covered. You're usually not going to get on the cover of a newspaper in year 7, in year 3, in year 2. So the fact that we've been able to keep a conservation project going for 7 years now and still get media exposure, get on the radio, get on TV and stuff, like that's just a testament, because we're not relying on the milestones. Like, hey, we made it to 10 years, care about us now. Like, we're making things happen. And I don't know, I see it as such a special opportunity to help the frogs and toads. And I'll say this, I haven't said this on another podcast, but in one of the episodes, it's very evident, it'll come out on Saturday, what was motivation and passion inside was able to give back and motivate what I did outside. So like keeping the animals and enjoying them and like really leaning into them when I'd gone through a lot of turmoil in life only spurned my passion on more and only encouraged me more to want to get out there and make a difference for their wild counterparts. So like, it's crazy how the vivariums can inspire and impact the wild populations of the animals that I keep. And I also work with outside. So like, that's just such a, I don't know how to explain that, but it's such a special opportunity to, you know, imagine looking in the glass box of what you're keeping. And then you go outside and you have a chance to make an impact. Like that's such a special opportunity.
Yeah, man. I mean, way to take that and then roll with it. I mean, having the right attitude is amazing. And for this, you know, conservation program being year 7 is really impressive and a testament to just how you come across. You come across quite inspiring, and you know, you say things at the forefront. And yeah, Josh's Frog, you know, shout outs to them. They are a huge company. You know, I live out here in Illinois, so I tend to see their you know, the vendor table when I go to Tinley. So
yeah,
that's awesome, man.
Yeah, thank you. There's been a lot along the way that's been a challenge, but like I said, I really do try to stay humble. I do try to articulate how thankful I am, you know, that you guys would give us an opportunity out here on your podcast, which is also another great platform. And I was telling Nate even that in one of the newspaper articles that came out on the cover for one of the local counties, you guys were actually mentioned as one of the events that we were doing this year. So like some of the podcasts that I appeared on made it into a local newspaper. So it's kind of funny how, like, you know, your podcast ended up being name dropped in a rural county in Pennsylvania. So I don't know. I just think that's really special, but you know, I am grateful. And like I said, I try to make sure to everybody that, you know, helps to lift this up, that you know, I celebrate you guys as well. And I'm so thankful that you guys would give me the light of day to be here and talk about this stuff. Cause there's so many people you could talk to, so many things you could be doing. And the fact that you guys give me an opportunity, especially on the week of the biggest conservation project that we're doing, is very important to me. And it means a lot.
Yeah.
So I've
touched on the whole dominoes effect thing as well, specifically with me and Bryant. Me a few years ago liking a few of his snake photos, and then back in April wound up in Colombia. So
yeah, one thing leads to another, and then you just go with it. But I'm curious with these continuous frog weeks each year, do you guys focus on a specific species, amphibian species each year, or, you know, talk a bit along what the previous frog weeks were and what is this up and coming frog week encompassing now?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I'm glad you set it up like that. Thank you. What I want to say first is I'm here kind of representing two different entities, because PA Woods and Forests is the nonprofit, and that's where the field work is getting done. But I'm also here to represent Woods and Forests Media, which is the YouTube channel and the Instagram. So once we founded our nonprofit, our treasurer said, listen, Aaron, I'm not going to do taxes on this thing. Like, if you're trying to monetize your channel, like, you got to do something else. So I said, say no more. I gave them the name, because actually the name for my YouTube channel and Instagram and everything was PA Woods and Forests. And I had to kind of separate it out, but it gave me an opportunity then to create my own thing. So now I have a media brand, and it's kind of like a Hulu or a Netflix where you could scroll through and there's like different shows. So like, we have a hiking show and different shows about animals and a lot of really neat stuff. But anyway, so that is the platform where Frog Week comes out on every year, and it's been that way since the beginning. But I'd say the first year, a lot of people made remarks about how it just seemed like a kid out there in the field taking pictures and just kind of happy to be there. And I mean, in some ways, I think that's true, because I just got into conservation, what that was going to look like. I didn't really know how we can make an impact. We're not with a government agency. We're not getting funding from like a national source. So all of this is just through sheer passion, motivation, and the community wanting to embrace it. And we wouldn't be here if it wasn't for, of course, the wild frogs and toads, but also the community at large and the people and places out, even outside of Pennsylvania, like Josh's Frogs, that have never given up on the project, or me. The first year we were just trying to find populations and see how we could help them. And then a lot of my friends who were just more so herpers at the time, that's like kind of where they kind of got off the bus, and I had a decision to make. This isn't just like a herping experience. This is like, think of me as a janitor or a custodian, somebody who's going to go into a habitat and want to help fix things, or want to make things right, or want to like problem solve and like figure out like what's going on here. That's kind of the way I look at it. So a little different from a herper, and a little bit different necessarily from a researcher, because like, I'm actively impacting the environment, not just writing it down, and I'm not just flipping a rock, and I'm not just photographing it either. So it's a little bit different than everybody is kind of used to. It's a little unorthodox from that perspective, but we have kind of created like a little logo, or tried to every year. It really started taking fire, I think, 2021. I'd say the way that you can think about it is almost like the sports games or magazines where they got like a cover animal, like cover athlete in a game, but like a cover animal. So it was like hopefully the highlight episode of that year was whoever was the logo animal for that year. And that's kind of the way that it's always gone. We would focus on whoever, it would be like the highlight episode, whoever was on the cover. It really has changed from 2019 to now. I mean, we got involved in a state amphibian survey, and we were doing stuff with them as well, but it started to get very niche, and it started to get to the point where if we wanted to really make an impact, if we wanted to help animals that we couldn't find, we needed their help to, they weren't as helpful. So it was like, well, then we're not really going to stay involved if we can't really make that much of an impact. So then there was a period of time where all of the records kind of ended, because we were going out and getting pictures and documenting the stuff on a nightly basis for 5-6 months in a row. And that is still how it goes. The field season for Frog Week starts in February and it ends in July. So I have about 4 terabytes worth of data right now, all the pictures and videos. And there's so many different stories that we could have told, but the ones that we highlighted for this year are the ones where we highlight the difference in the project. So doing an acoustic monitoring project, doing an iNaturalist citizen science project without compromising the location of where the animals exist. We're doing presentations in classrooms, allowing kids to raise tadpoles and then taking those baby frogs and toads back to the wild, allowing them to reestablish their populations that are kind of, some of them are in edge habitats, but they're vernal pool breeders. So their habitats are drying up a lot faster. And that's one of the answers that I came up with. Of course, monitoring and doing maintenance with the habitats, but also, like there is a bit of detective work in the early years. It was trying to find the eastern gray tree frog in a couple counties where historically it was never documented. Nobody ever had proof. And even if they found like one, if they got like one picture, there was no absolute proof it was this frog and that the population was there. Could it have been a pet that they got a picture of? Well, in 2021, after a lot of detective work, almost like Jeremy Wade on Animal Planet, like knowing somebody that knows somebody that knows somebody in this like remote area, we were able to find the eastern gray tree frog in 2 different counties as a range extension, basically. And then 2023, we found the northern map turtle. So we have kind of inked out a few like novel discoveries in the region, which is really special that we contribute. And there's other stuff too that we found, like spotted salamanders double clutching in a year, and certain frogs and toads were using a bridge to go from one county to the next. So there's some really special things we were able to observe, and just wanting to do maintenance and work with the neighbors to promote backyard stewardship and conservation. So there's so much that we could talk about here. It's such a deep project. And I guess last thing I'll say too is how the animals that I've pulled in with a state educator permit, so that way it's all legal and everything is filed correctly with the state. So I have an educator permit that allows me to bring in frogs and toads, and creating those environments, being obsessed with wanting to create large zoo-like enclosures and even going above and beyond. So like on Saturday's episode, the American toads, they live in a 242-gallon tank with thunderstorms, with fog, with cold fronts and warm fronts. There's an air conditioner that controls a lot of that. There's native plants that are growing. I have an ant colony. I have a lot of things that I've done a lot of research on, where they get a lot of stimulation. They get audio stimulation. They also have a planetarium. So like they can see the stars, they can see the moon moving throughout the night. Also, like I said about their diet as well, I spent a lot of time working with zoos and mostly vets though, a lot of vets on diet. But anyway, I just wanted to say that because like that's even another deeper level we could talk about. So there's so many segments, so many different aspects of this project that are important and that make this such a passion project, but also something that I'm so invested in, that I could talk about any angle of this that you want to.
Well, my main takeaway, Aaron, is that you're a go-getter, and you kind of epitomize the saying where, you know, the old quote is, it's lonely at the top. Well, I mean, it shouldn't be in a real world scenario. And you kind of epitomize that where it's not lonely at the top. I mean, you give credit where it's credit due. I kind of wanted to touch on a little bit of the collaboration side. Obviously, you mentioned zoos and whatnot. Anything with uni, like a university involvement?
Yeah, so one of my alma maters, the University of Pittsburgh at Johnstown, I've done a lot of presentations there the last couple of years, but we are talking about, so there's a couple of things. One is, they reached out to me. This might sound boring to some viewers. It might sound very intriguing to others, but they're doing soil judging. There's like a really big project. There's a really big like event that they're going to have on campus. And like they reached out to me to like film it and want to create content for it, which is really cool that I get a chance, since they're creating a new department for environmental science, that I get to like help them define that with like with media, but there's also opportunities where we've done like our first ever salamander walk this year, and we did some frog walks on campus. So I am looking to collaborate with some of the schools and make it make sense though too, not to just say, oh, I got all these places. Like, I want to work with places that we can have that discussion whenever the camera's not on, or we can have that discussion after the project is over. You know, it's not like, hey, come and do this and then be gone, depart from me, right? Like, that's not necessarily like the kind of, so I look to try to build lasting relationships, and that's what I show with like Josh's Frogs, but also like Amphibicast and some of these other guys. It's been years, like some of these places, like even where we've had some of our frog walks, these nonprofits we partnered with. I guess let me give you an example here. So PA Woods and Forests is a traveling nonprofit. I don't know if that's a concept a lot of people are familiar with, but we don't own land, which gives us the opportunity to work with whoever we want, but also gives us the chance to highlight different creatures or different habitats or ecosystems, or even talk about problems that might be taking place on other groups' lands. So we can magnify what other groups are doing and work in step with them, but also we could go work with whoever we choose. And I think that is a very unique strategy that a lot of people haven't utilized, and it is kind of difficult to define it, but it seems like it has caught on in this region. I mean, we do target 7 counties over 150 miles, but we don't right now own land, so that gives us kind of some opportunity to move around and work with people.
Speaking of moving around, have you ever considered expanding Frog Week outside of Pennsylvania, say to like West Virginia or Ohio?
Well, that's a good question. So last year, I really was trying hard. I wanted to get a couple other big projects that I knew of to like just collaborate. It didn't mean that they needed to take a back seat. Could we highlight their projects and magnify them? So, and I have no problem with sharing the spotlight. So like there is Frog ID in Australia that takes place in the wintertime. And there's also like Project Golden Frog. And those are two really big projects, two really big initiatives that I really support, and I think they're great. One of them I tried to reach out to, the other one I had not tried to reach out to, but I would love to collaborate with some of these other projects if we can make it happen and magnify what everybody's doing, because we're all on the same mission. It's just we're doing it in different places with different creatures and for a different reason. But at the end of the day, we all come back to we want to see the environment better for these animals, and we want to see them persevere. So I don't have a problem whatsoever with collaborating. Now, you said about going to different states. In 2020, we went down to Maryland for an episode, and we were actually road rescuing some crabs off the road, and we went to Azateque, and we found some Fowler's toads, and we were like just kind of observing them, because in our region the Fowler's toad actually declined to the point where it's almost impossible to find it. So it was the first time for some viewers, and it has been the only time at this point the viewers got a chance to see what a Fowler's toad looked like in the wild. So I'm not opposed to it, and it sounds like my vacuum in real time is just going to start cleaning my room, so I apologize for that. Give me 1 second to have it go back.
Oh, no worries, man. We didn't hear it. But, I mean, PA is a pretty big state, so, I mean, you have a lot of room if you just want to stay centralized, you know. I just recently looked it up, and, you know, PA has quite the amphibian cast of a species. You guys got a lot.
So are you guys both from the same state, or are you guys in separate states?
Separate states.
Nate's from Ohio. I'm from Illinois.
Oh, so you guys are still like not super far away from me though. So that's, I mean, I've driven to Michigan. So like Illinois, I mean, I drove through Chicago in the middle of the night, and that was an experience. It was fun. So from like Western Pennsylvania to the Chicago Bridge, I wasn't passed. So that was a wild stat. I don't necessarily like to claim, but it is very, it's interesting if you think about it. It's honestly, like though, 9 hours.
Yeah, honestly, though, the best time to drive through downtown Chicago would be in the middle of the night.
Depends on what parts, but yeah, you're not wrong. I'm more in central Illinois, but yeah. That is quite a drive when you think about it.
Yeah, no, I'm not opposed to it. In 2022, there's an episode with some of the guys from Josh's Frogs. We went out and we did herping like in Michigan. So I think that it's fun for like specials, and it would definitely be fun to get other places involved and include them. So I'm not opposed to traveling to like West Virginia or Ohio or like Illinois or some different places. I want to make sure that it all makes sense, so we got some good like stuff to do. But yeah, that's not something that I'm opposed to doing, even if it would be like more independent, if it took place during Frog Week or after Frog Week or whatever. But I wouldn't be opposed to wanting to come out there and check that stuff out either. So yeah, I'm gonna leave the door open for any of that stuff to take place.
Yeah, but I mean, like I alluded to, you already have your hands full in PA with what you're doing with Frog Week and just, you guys overall and initiatives. And like I was alluding to beforehand, too, you guys have quite the species of amphibians. I mean, I suppose how many amphibian species do you think you've knocked off the PA list?
Well, I know there's like, I think what, 22 or 23 salamanders, or maybe a few more, and then there's supposed to be 18 frogs and toads. Even though we have that many for both salamanders and frogs, that doesn't mean that sadly they're all abundant, and it doesn't mean that they are all still in the state. So some of the work that the state's doing is trying to identify, hey, is the tiger salamander here, or has it been gone? It's been classified as extirpated for a while now, but is it still here? So like there's ongoing research that's taken place to figure that stuff out. Or are there, let's play devil's advocate here, is the green tree frog migrating from Maryland to the southeast region of Pennsylvania? Well, nobody really has that answer. But if you think about like climate changing, and you think about like it getting warmer, the green tree frog is literally just over the river, like comes in on a boat, comes in on somebody's car, or on some plants, like starts establishing. I mean, it could become another native species, but then what do you do with that, right? Do you say it's native? Did it, is it truly invasive? Is it an immigrant species? Like, what do you call that? So it's, but those are some of the same thing with the barking tree frog, which is in Maryland. And the reason why I bring that up is there's some suggestion that, and I'm not sure where I stand on the issue, but there's suggestion that the Cope's gray tree frog came in from West Virginia and Maryland, and that's why it's on the outskirts of the state. But it's moved pretty far, like towards the mountains now. So that's why I'm not, like I'm saying, I'm playing devil's advocate here. I don't necessarily know like if that is the case, that it actually moved in from other states, or if it was always here and we just didn't know. But those are things that, could potentially impact the project too. It's like, do we want to find that answer out, or do we want to go down and investigate a place? There are a few salamanders that do make appearances in Frog Week. So the spotted salamander has been notorious because it breeds alongside the frogs. I have a contact who reached out to us during one of our hikes this year, and they said about there might be a spot for Jefferson salamanders, and we've never filmed those before. And it's a unique salamander along the same line, same family as the spotted. So that would be really neat to see if we could help them. Very rare to find in our region. So again, that's another species that would be really cool. So some of the woodland salamanders are also just out there. They don't necessarily make the appearance in the project, but we do have for the nonprofit a couple target species. Like the slimy salamander is probably one of, if not the most abundant salamander in the state, along with the redback salamander. But the slimy salamander is just such a unique little critter. It'll actually guard its eggs, and they're forest salamanders, so they're found away from water. You don't want to mess with them because you can get your hand stuck almost like super glue. But they're just such a, they're such a cool little salamander, and I really do respect them. But we have about seven or eight different frog species for this project that we highlight. But that could change if we add another county, which we're in talks with. We could potentially add three more species, and now we're at 10 frogs for the project. So there's some interesting conversations taking place. I'm not gonna definitively go one way or the other with it because you just never know. But yeah, could there be other frogs, new frogs that we're hunting for Frog Week 2026? I mean, it's very likely.
Yeah, and I'm curious. I don't really want to switch gears too much, but you said you have some captives. Like the way you're describing this toad enclosure, it's like, oh my goodness. I mean, that's far and beyond what most, I guess, you know, captive keepers would do for just what some people would say are kind of lesser things. But I mean that's amazing.
It's much more elaborate than what most zoos would do.
Yeah, the way you're describing it, dude, it sounds fantastic. Like, shoot, I'd move into that enclosure.
It's big enough we could sit in there if you wanted to. So we could do the podcast in there.
Oh yeah.
No, don't yourself.
Yeah. Although if we have a high pitched sound, it's gonna hurt because it's an acrylic. It's I think it's 3/4 inch plexiglass. It was custom made by a place in Florida. But I can talk about that for a second. So I also am somebody, once the field season ends, and if I'm not looking at how we're going to build this project, I'm really nerding out in little details. How can I impact the animals that I keep? And I'm always selfish about spending time just going down these rabbit holes, like, oh, is this something I could add? Is it something I could do? Is this plant toxic? Because you have to understand, for this project, I'm working with native plants that are from Pennsylvania. So, like, you have to know, like, do they produce toxic berries? Because insects living in the ecosystem where the toads are will eat those berries, and then could they kill the toads? So, like, there's so many minute details that lead into the bigger picture. It makes it even more interesting whenever you peel back all the layers of this. It is a very fun tank to film. I have a reverse osmosis system. I also spent some money investing in a rain barrel and other things as well. But like, I'll even go out. I've been growing trees just for leaf litter, so I can like get my own leaf litter. So it's not like I'm picking up off the ground where the grass could have been sprayed for like chemicals on lawns. There's no like incidental stuff that takes place. Like, I've spent years trying to make sure that I don't put the animals in harm's way to give them as close to a natural environment as possible. Their tank is going to get redone, and I'm really excited for this part. So imagine a little hillside stream, a little hillside like runoff after rainfall. You got water trickling down, and it looks kind of peaceful. Well, the frogs and toads will use that in the wild. So I spent some time looking at a filter that has a UV clarifier as well, like a light attached to it, so that way I could sterilize the water, but create a little like stream running into a body of water for the toads. And then, you know, we could even showcase how maybe the water dries up as the years go on, or as the season goes on. So that's kind of cool. But in Saturday's episode, what I'm really excited to show people, it's like a cold opening. Nobody knows necessarily like what's going on. And then all of a sudden there's a camera in the enclosure and you start hearing an isolated thunderstorm taking place. But I have a waterproof camera that is in there, and you can see it from the one toad's perspective. Like, she hears the thunder rolling and she reacts to it. And like, it's what I've been trying to do for 5 years. So like, the fact that it took place so quickly and so like effortlessly, like that flow of the video, I think the first couple minutes, if you're not hooked, then I don't know what to say, but it's going to be pretty epic to see a thunderstorm roll in from a toad's perspective out in the field.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned like native plants taking note of what's there. A lot of keepers care about their animals, their feeders' gut loads. Meanwhile, you're concerned about a potential lethal gut load for a wild population.
Yeah, let me clarify that. So also, I'm concerned if I bring in a wild plant to grow in my enclosure, could crickets or isopods eat that, and then my frogs and toads eat them and get sick? So I have to like be very careful I don't bring something in that could get them sick as well.
Yeah, awesome. But very elaborate what you're describing. I mean, this is awesome. I'm excited to watch these videos and up and coming ones, you know. So, you know, you said, you know, you do presentations off location and whatnot. How many locations would you say each year you visit and present at?
So I guess the way to break things down, and there's ironically today, it's called Critter Talks, and that episode came out. So I go to schools and I present. This year we got grant funding. I brought pitcher plants, giant American millipedes, and tadpoles to the classroom and allowed 10 different classrooms, 6 different schools to raise these critters. And I brought wood frog tadpoles. They had a chance to raise those tadpoles, and then once they became baby frogs, they went back to the wild, and we had a chance to share with them. All of the schools want me to come back, and they're also, some of the teachers have talked about the curriculum. If they don't have a lesson plan, or whenever I come back, either in the fall or the spring, they're going to show some of these videos and get the kids ready for me coming back. And imagine how that is going to go. Like, there's kids who are in like first grade, second grade, third grade, and all the way up to college. But anyway, like, so a lot of elementary school kids are going to watch content about these frogs and toads, whether it's out in the wild or in my enclosures. And then I have a chance to potentially bring some of those to their classroom so they get a chance to meet them. So imagine, like, if you got hooked on your favorite TV show in nature as a kid, and that person with the animals or whatever came to visit you, like, how special that could be for these kids to grow up and maybe become the next group of conservationists or whatever. So I'm looking to get into as many schools as I can. But when we're talking about field sites, if you're talking about in the 150 miles of 7 counties, I could say I could break it down where I think there's around 7 to 10 populations of wood frogs. There's probably like 13 populations of American toads. Spring peepers are at every single population. Green frogs are also. We don't really monitor the green frogs, the bullfrogs, and the spring peepers because they're just so abundant. And the green frog and spring peeper appear to increase. They're increasing, whereas the other species are not. Some are even potentially decreasing. So,
yeah. Well, I don't want to take away from this, but just how great and immersive, you know, initiatives like that you do in schools. I mean, maybe I was chatting with Nate about this or somebody else, but, you know, as we get further in the future with AI technology and screen technology and whatnot, you know, it seems, and I'm already seeing it in, you know, these younger generations, there's much more of a disconnect from nature and people, and especially like, you know, native stuff, you know, there seems to be more of a disconnect. So how fantastic that, you know, you and others, what you guys are doing is really inspiring. Like you said, you could inspire the next, what, Steve Irwin or Jeff Corwin or something along those lines.
Exactly. He was funny. Yeah, he was awesome. yeah, exactly. So I think that gives a lot of credibility to the project, but I'll give you an example. So after I had done all these presentations to these different schools, I was with my girlfriend. We're out at Lowe's, just randomly. I'm looking for plants or whatever, like just doing my thing. Had nothing to do with frogs whatsoever. We're walking down like a main part of the store, and this little kid with his mom, he's like, "What's up, frog man?" And he just keeps walking. And his mom was like, "Did you just insult him?" Like she didn't get it, but like, there are people who, like, the kids are just like, they recognize me. Even I didn't recognize, I don't know what school the kid went to, but it's just kind of funny how some of them are seeing me out there and they're just like, "Oh, what's up?" Like, they're like, I was getting my hair cut at a place and somebody's like, "Oh, I watch your videos." Like, that's kind of cool because it's not a huge following for one. And we don't have like only 10 people in our town or in these different counties. So it's just crazy that it's becoming recognizable. And who would have thought, somebody who watched a toad and saw its personality inside would get so encouraged and inspired to want to impact the rest of the population and also take that same mission and want to encourage the next group of people who can make an impact on their life. So, yeah, I think it's a really special thing. And I'm really happy you talked about that and brought that up, too. I think that's going to be the future, and that's our target audience for PA Woods and Forests and the nonprofit. We want to build backyard habitats. We've just finished one in a Bible camp today. We installed a weather station. We got a little like habitat to try to attract vernal pool breeders, and we got some native like aquatic plants growing there. We also seeded the habitat with wild plants, and also we also put a bee house for leafcutter bees. So we're trying to build things in backyards and teach kids environmental stewardship, but now even like bringing that stuff to the classroom and letting them raise it, or presenting it to them, like I've seen them so invested. So it might be true where there's a disconnect, but if you go and you try to reach for it, if you try to like make an effort for it, they're still the same impressionable minds. It's still the same opportunity. It just depends on, like, for one, how bad do you want it? For two, what, like, they only care about if you're genuine, if your mission is authentic. Like, if I went in there and started talking about something I didn't care about, they're going to fall asleep. They're going to start texting. They're going to pick their nose. They're going to do whatever. But like, if I go in there and start talking about how my life changed and how this is impacting the rest of the state and how like they could do this when they grow up, like some, like you said about inspiring them, but just bringing reality to them, I think has really made the difference for this.
Yeah, man. I mean, outreach like that is the future, is key. So I mean, kudos to you and perseverance. I think that's the main takeaway, is just perseverance and consistency, which is what you've been doing since you're in year seven, right? So
yeah.
Kudos to you. You know, it seems like amphibian based conservation efforts aren't really mentioned a lot or in the spotlight as much as you maybe alluded to before. Obviously there's projects that are somewhat known, like the, like a Flatwood Salamanders.
Yeah, the Amphibian Foundation. Yeah.
Amphibian Foundation. Like there's organizations and whatnot, but they don't tend to take center stage as opposed to mammalian or avian or even reptilian conservation efforts. So, you know, it's great to have, you know, more diversity in that realm of conservation and just overall programs such as yours.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that, because I think a lot of people look at what we do is, you know, it's still kind of unconventional or taboo. Like people will say it's native species. Like it's almost similar to like controversial. Like people will say, I don't know how I feel about that, but they also deserve our care too. And I get it. Like I'm not trying to go out and catch them all like Pokemon. I don't have thousands of native frogs and toads. I have so much opportunity to go and catch them. But anyway, I have a state permit and I have to be held to that, which is great. But I also don't promote like leaking their location. So like imagine this, I'm somebody who gets on the cover of newspapers and goes on TV and I talk about a conservation project for frogs and they're like, oh, where's it at? Is it in our viewing area? And I'll be like, well, it's in this county. And you know, I have to be general about it, because I found that people will sell them like at reptile expos in other states where the animal's not native to, or like sell them on eBay, or like there's people that'll feed some of these frogs to their snakes. So like, and I'm not throwing any shade at reptiles whatsoever. I have a skink, and I actually, if I were to keep any reptiles, I mean, I would probably want to keep like the five line skink, because I could get that on my permit. I just would have to find where they exist. But anyway, I just wanted to throw that out there, so that way the reptile people don't think I hate them or that I oppose them. Like I really love lizards. Like I think it would be probably toads, tree frogs, pitcher plants, and lizards, and like a few different groups of insects, but like lizards are in my top five of like, I would go out of my way to like help them or see them. Like I really like lizards. Some snakes are cool too, but anyway, I just wanted to throw that out there. So I'm not throwing shade at reptile keepers, especially those who might even need to use like frozen thawed frogs. Like I'm not coming at them, but there are people also who are bad actors, and those are the ones that, you know, if I'm a walking billboard to say, hey, there's frogs here and they're looking to save some money, you know, I have to take all that into consideration. If I go do a news show or if I go like do radio, I can't be like, oh, in this location exactly, and you can find it on iNaturalist. So like I obscure the data, only give county records for iNaturalist, never went out with any of the people that were a part of the project. So even if they put like where they found stuff, it has no meaning whatsoever to where I was. And for years, all seven, like I've been very careful to guard the locations so that way people don't leak them and give them away, so we don't lose these populations.
Well, I mean, I guess touch on that a little bit. Like, what are, besides, you were talking about the gray tree frog, which is relatively on the fringes, you're saying, but what are some of the other endangered amphibians that you guys focus on?
Yeah, so right now we're gearing up. There's the potential to work with actually federally listed or at least state listed creatures that are declining. For us though, think about, I guess here's a good example. Think about your grandparents and when they were our age. I said this to some kids earlier today. They were like first grade to sixth grade. So in a generation, in a lifetime, there are a handful of species that have disappeared, and nobody really figured out why or started talking about it until they saw like the last one. They're like, oh, they're gone now. I guess this is a problem. Or, oh, they're gone, and just shrugged their shoulders and it didn't matter. Well, because of my background, and I can actually do some research, or I could actually do like different things with creating a call to action. If there seems to be a decline or there seems to be a problem, our nonprofit is also in the trenches to try to help, like I said, as a janitor or a maintenance person, to try to fix that problem in some ways. So if the vernal pools in the mountains in Pennsylvania and Western Pennsylvania, if the vernal pools are drying up faster because it's getting hotter, or habitats are getting bulldozed over for like a Dollar General or like a bank or something, I'm not trying to like talk down on them. I'm just saying, for example, because that is actually what happens. So if these habitats are getting bulldozed over, they have nowhere to go, or the pools have dried up completely and now there's nowhere for they die immediately. So if we create backyard habitats, now not only do we give those frogs and toads or salamanders a chance to find a new habitat, but the people that live in that area are going to want to fill the water up. They're going to want to see the progress of the tadpoles. They're going to want to spend that time caring about them. But also, we've created wildlife corridors. The state parks and the forests and the national parks and forests and everything, they have so much funding and people are getting paid to do those jobs. Nobody's really targeting the backyards and trying to either create wildlife corridors or creating environmental stewardship within their community, within their neighborhood. And like, for an example, for us, probably the most notorious animal for Frog Week, the American toad, had declined in my neighborhood 10 years ago and it was almost gone. My parents put in a pond and we found a pair of American toads that just decided they were going to lay their eggs in this fish pond. And it was kind of one of the foundations of one of the locations of the project, because that bold move that those toads made, and it actually happened before, it's actually older than the project and the nonprofit. Like, these toads had been breeding in this pond before any of the conservation started, and so we caught up to them at a point where it's like, now we care about their habitat, we care about their pond, we care about like seeing them exist and continue. And so some of the neighbors who also maybe have like little backyard ponds also are a part of this project and also care about it. So now, you know, road rescuing American toads, finding 11 of them on a busy road on a rainy night and taking them to some of these ponds, allowing them to get there, or if they're trying to cross the road to get to the pond, keeping an eye out for them and going and catching them, grabbing them, bringing them over, is a really big deal, because now we're helping the population in ways that they would not have been helped beforehand. So that's probably one of the ways that I could go with this, is, you know, the American toad potentially declining in some regions, creating these backyard habitats could create a habitat for the toads to live, but also a place for the baby toads. Once they emerge from the water, they have a shelter, they have a place to go. So there's so much that goes into like the habitat creation and the thought process of like what we could do to help some of these animals.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned toads, because, you know, in communities, you know, some people will have, you know, a yard toad or whatnot. But besides knowing that they have a yard toad, you know, they don't really add any more sentiment or thought into, you know, what you know, what's going on with this toad. It's just one pair. I mean, I've seen in similar community or in some communities around me where, you know, you used to see toads and then just completely they fail off population wise. So, you know, I guess maybe touch on a little bit of, you know, the community involvement. You know, what are some, do you have any stories in particular of that sort of thing, community involvement? You were saying some people are, I guess, getting involved with Frog Week and maybe watering their garden a bit more, or maybe planting natives, things along those lines.
Oh, definitely. Especially because we do things like frog walks, and we've had the public come out and we've gotten some really good results over the years. So people who might not even want to become a volunteer, but they really appreciate what we're doing, they might go back now and want to water, or they might want to plant something, or they want to, you know, they want to care a little bit more about their backyard toads. So they're looking for them, or they'll email sightings to us, which is really cool. I would say last year, the American Toad episode, which has actually become the most viewed episode of Frog Week history at this point, it talks about how I went up to the neighbor's pond and we kind of highlighted how the toad population will move between the two ponds. And there was a pair of American toads, a male on the female's back, and she was coming down from the neighbor's yard and literally had crossed yards to go under our fence and to come to the pond. And like I actually walked up and showed how she was coming to, because she, for whatever reason, didn't want to lay in that pond. So she came to ours, but they'll do either one. This year, what I would say for an exciting episode for people, in the Cambria County region, in that county where we found the Eastern Gray Tree Frog, so there are neighbors who helped us to find them, but there's also the same neighbors there for years now. 2021 was when we found the population, but there have been neighbors who have stepped up that go out and listen for them, or if they see them in jeopardy, like they'll move them off of a road, or like one place we're going to build a habitat, a satellite habitat, to try to encourage them to come to this place to reproduce because some of the pools are drying up. And it's a species, it's not necessarily like declining, but I think in wildlife, especially when we think about our native species, we talk about things like, oh, it's so abundant, it's so common, but the reality is, just because it's listed as common or abundant doesn't mean you're going to go down the street and find all of them. You're going to only maybe see that animal in some rare spots in certain counties or maybe a region. So we don't know how many there are, and there could be a lot of them, or there could be only the populations that we found in these mountain populations. And how different are they if they're isolated from other populations in valleys? But anyway, the fact that we have some people who help out, and I want to give a shout out to Ed, who has been a big part of it. And if you watch the Gray Tree Frog episode that comes out tomorrow, in 2021, you see Ed, and he's got like hair, and he's like, he's an older guy, but he's got hair. He looks really good. He's in good shape. He was real strong. He would shake your hand really firm. And then over the next couple years, he ended up having some health issues where like he survived cancer. He survived, like, I think he had a stroke, and he had some horrible stuff take place. And you could see that because like he still appeared in some of the episodes, but just a little bit less. And then this year, as he's coming out of all of that, but I mean, it still took a toll on him. You can see like he looks better, but not where he was at in 21. But it was just his willingness, whether he had a cane after just recovering from some of the stuff, or like, this year he offered an ATV and we were covering a couple miles to go down and look for the gray tree frogs. Like his dedication to this, his willingness, like if he's like, if the ATV is out there, there was a spot where he'd put the key and like I could go and I could take it. And it's like the middle of the night and I only met this guy because he had frogs in his backyard. Like, isn't that crazy? And like, now I'm taking a big machine, like a big vehicle, and I'm driving around. Like, that's just, it blows my mind. But there's some great people that, you know, they want to be a part of this stuff, and think about them having kids or their families, how that makes them feel valuable. Like they have a part of the story of keeping and maintaining these animals that some other people might not know exist, or, you know, it's their secret to keep. And a lot of people are really excited to be a part of it. So it is special to have the community involved.
Yeah. I mean, being natural stewards, it's something relatively foreign to most folks, but once you kind of bring it into light, I think most people are in agreeance that, you know, they can do a little bit more, or that anyone can do something or be involved in some type of way.
Sure. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And that's what I want people to get out of this, to think about it, reflect on how we can make the biggest difference. We can make the biggest difference with our wild frogs and toads if we choose to care about them. And it could even be reptiles, different snakes. It could be different lizards, depending on where you're located. You know, if you care about something, then you're going to want to go out of your way. You're going to want to make sure that it's taken care of. You're going to want to see it succeed. But if you just ignore it, or I think even us in like the community with like keeping reptiles and amphibians, sometimes we have a tendency to separate like what I keep and what I do is separate from what's out there. But like if we could kind of break that barrier, like break down that wall and say, well, yeah, I'm keeping, even if it's exotic stuff, but like, you know, I still have an opportunity. I still have a role to play in my neighborhood, in my community. It doesn't mean that you're going to tie into PA Woods and Forests or that you're going to go out and like start your own nonprofit or get government assistance to like create an initiative. But just by choosing to not cause harm or not ignore or overlook the local populations is also, I think, it just as important. So I hope people will take that away from all this too.
Yeah. And you mentioned something earlier about, I guess, you know, species being abundant or seemingly so. I think most people kind of lack lack the concept of meta populations. You know, the species may be abundant, but each population, maybe not so the case, as you kind of talked about with American toads. So that kind of leads me into with the surveying and whatnot. Are you saying you guys are also getting involved with habitat restoration for some of these species?
So there's some different options that we have here. Whether we're building backyard habitats to try to encourage vernal pool breeders to get out of drying pools or habitats that are going to disappear from like timber harvesting, or maybe they're polluted. We're trying to offer a better option for them, but there's also an organization we worked with where they have a bog and they were trying to reintroduce a few species of plants that were lost. And the purple pitcher plant, which is native to Pennsylvania, we spent a lot of time, a couple years, trying to do some research on that area. And a lot of researchers came back and said that it once very likely existed in this place. The reason where I'm going with this is so the purple pitcher plant is a shelter for tree frogs. So like spring peepers and gray tree frogs will sleep inside of the tubes, and they're actually immune to the enzymes that the plant has beneath it. So there's like a little liquid. It's like a water bottle that is half full or a quarter of the way full. And there's like an acidic enzyme that is at the bottom of the plant if you fall in the leaves. So salamanders, like spotted salamanders and newts that make their way into bogs, whether it's to try to breed or to just swim around to explore a new area, they actually get eaten by the plant, but tree frogs don't. They have a symbiotic relationship. So the plant can exist without tree frogs, but it also can benefit from them. And carnivorous plants do not get fertilized, so they have to rely on catching insects. But also, one of the ways they've evolved is that they have frogs eat the insects that they lure to the plant, and then the frogs will poop in the plant, and the plant will actually eat frog poop. I know that might not be the most appetizing thing to talk about, but creating another little shelter for tree frog species, just something as small as that, but it's so much of a talking point. It's a, you know, a carnivorous plant, and it lives in the mountains in Pennsylvania. It eats insects and salamanders, but it's a frog shelter. So, and it lives in the same environment as them. So that's one thing that we were doing too. Like, are there certain plants that we could bring to the habitat that would make a difference, that would make an impact for wild populations? And, you know, there, whether it's that or it's creating these smaller habitats, honestly, even putting in these weather stations, these backyard weather stations, to see like what the rainfall is. So, you know, we talked about meta populations. What about like microclimates, and how each habitat across 150 miles might have experienced the summer differently? Somebody got more rain than somebody else, especially when you talk about so much drastic elevation change, to figure out, you know, how that impacted their breeding season. There's so much detail that goes into that even. And we were deploying trail cameras to see if we could find the target species arrive and see, you know, what we came up with. And the last episode of Frog Week on Sunday, I was able to showcase, I have like 5,000 clips of trail cams with American toads wrestling. So people have a chance to see a couple minutes of that backyard octagon that they created in the pond.
That's pretty cool. You know, I usually wouldn't make the association with trail cam footage and amphibians. So that's actually really fascinating. Has it only just been American toads documented on these trail cam footage or other species as well?
Well, it's kind of funny because it originally was for the wood frog, and the first time we got it was, I think, 2 years ago, but it was very hard. I don't know how the wood frogs know, but they, it, like backyard habitats specifically, they just kind of know where things are and they avoid certain things. So it was hiding in this dense vegetation. You could just kind of see its head. It was like we were getting odds and ends clips. And then this year for the first episode of Frog Week, I did like a Facebook Live and I said, oh, I got my trail camera and I'm going to try to put it up, but I have to go to work for 10 hours. And I was working overnight at the time. And so I put the trail cam out and I didn't realize for some reason it wasn't getting triggered. I don't know why it wasn't working, but it wasn't getting triggered by the wood frogs. And I was so frustrated because the night that I set it out would have been amazing to watch on the trail cam. So we started with like 50s and 60s and rain. And then in 10 hours, when I went back to get the trail cam, we had almost like a little flurry come down and the ground was completely covered in snow. Thankfully, the weather conditions were good enough that the wood frogs didn't just end their breeding season on one night, because sometimes that happens. They'll breed one night and that's it. So thankfully, I was able to go back and they were still breeding for a couple days and I got some footage. But we did get some wood frogs in episode one, trail cam footage of them swimming around. And they gather on this very high mountain in Pennsylvania. And I'm able to film them, but there's like thousands of wood frogs. It's one of the most deafening choruses. It actually can hurt your ears. And when I was going to get tadpoles for the different classrooms, I was like walking up on it and I didn't have my headlight or anything too powerful. And I just started hearing this sound and I was like, what in the world am I listening to? And I was able to like shine in the little pools. And it was a school of tadpoles and their mouths were moving. There were so many of them that they were making, like you could hear the sound from like far enough away in the forest where it's like, what is that sound? So there was that many of those tadpoles. So it's a really special episode. And yeah, that's kind of where it started. And we're hoping that if we introduce PVC pipe to some of these habitats, that we could also attach trail cams kind of like more up, not just on the ground, and maybe we could see like tree frogs using the PVC tubes going in and out of them, almost like a gargoyle or almost like, you know, a vampire. Like they come out at night and then they retreat to the PVC tube, and that would be pretty neat for people to get that kind of footage. So I mean, that's one thing we are potentially kicking around that we could use the trail cams for next.
That's awesome. And thank you for sparking a memory I had when you said, you know, you, when you go to these vernal pool sites and like the noise can be so deafening. I remember quite a few years back with a buddy of mine, we went to a well-known vernal pool area spot, and for wood frogs, ironically, and my goodness, the cacophony is just incredible. But it's also incredible to be in areas where there's so many, there's so much happening going on, so much breeding that it's deafening. You know, it's a good sign. You'd rather have that cacophony than not have it.
Yeah. So I guess there's an interesting thing here where each habitat is at the mercy of something different. So this habitat has deep pools and the water usually lasts for a very long time. So the wood frog tadpoles, in an ideal world, they would never die. They would always be able to develop and get out, and it's a perfect world. So they don't worry about the pools drying up at this habitat because they normally won't. And if the weather gets bad, it's the top of a mountain. They're going to get the most rain dumped on them. So they're going to be in a good spot for a long time. But here's the problem, though. It's a catch-22. Where other pools of water are drying up and need that kind of rain, if you have already a lot of water in the pool, then what happens is you start flooding and that water starts traveling. So then the tadpoles also start traveling with that water. And this year, I went out on a pretty heavy rainstorm to the top of this mountain, and I was very surprised to see that there was a little stream that had been coming out of that larger body of water, and there were tadpoles that were getting caught, and they were like rolling basically down off the mountain. It was going into a wetland somewhere, but you never knew where that was going to go or if that was going to dry up. So I was literally on a dirt road on a mountain, like with a fishnet, catching hundreds of wood frog tadpoles, whether they were going to classrooms or I was throwing them in different spots where the water was deeper, like to try to encourage them to not go and make the same mistake. But that was like hours trying to do that. And I would have not expected to walk up on something like that. But again, it's almost like a teeter-totter, right? Like certain places need that water, but other places they don't need that water. So it's like, well, do you hope for it to rain or do you hope it doesn't rain? It's like, well, who needs it more? So it puts you in a very odd spot sometimes.
It is, because some could say that's active management and others could say, well, why not let nature be nature? You know, why interfere when that, you know, naturally that seems like a dispersal event, but like you're alluding to, you mean, well, maybe you should take that. Why? Like, why not let it? Why interfere?
I think you got a lot of really good insight too. So you could have easily taken that, but I'll just say that even though it sounds like, and there's a episode, actually the bullfrog episode this year, we covered that where a bullfrog in my backyard, it was fight or flight. It ate an American toad. And this is almost like a little toad hatchery for 10 years now. They've been coming here, and the American toads in our backyard have kind of adapted. They've almost like evolved to be smaller to avoid cars. So if you're smaller, you're quicker and it's faster to cross a road, but you're also at the mercy of a larger bullfrog. You're the perfect appetizer for a bullfrog. And it had been eating a couple of them, I think, because it was chubby enough where it looked like that. But I would not do this in the wild. And I always leave this open for people to feel however they want to. I don't want you to necessarily take my side, but like I panicked when I saw it. I don't know why I did, but I actually went into action and was very strategic and careful how I opened up the mouth and pulled the toad out of the bullfrog's mouth. It was like little toes twitching. It was literally an inch away from, that was it. Like that toad would have been eaten and it would have been over. But that toad has actually now gone to a lot of schools and I've done presentations with since he cheated death. And I feel like it was somewhat selfish. I didn't put him back in the wild. But to get back to like our point here, you could say, well, you know, do I just leave it be? And do I just let the bullfrogs who also were born in this area persist? And like, you know, what happens if they eat 3 American toads a night and we go from 18 toads down to 3 or 4, and then the next year down to 0, because it takes 2 years for the American toad to become mature enough to breed. So we could have lost them all to these 2 bullfrogs. And that's kind of where you have to ask yourself. So like, what are you willing to get involved in? Like, what makes the most sense? There's going to be winners and losers. Like, how do you base that? How do you judge that? And even though that's a harsh reality, that sucks. We're not trying to like take away from the bullfrog or discredit the bullfrog or like make people hate them. But at the same time, we're also not trying to make the American toad to be the most valuable thing in the project. So like trying to walk that line and try to remain unbiased and try to remain like objective. Sometimes like
still there, Aaron?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
That's it. Just went in and out, but all I was gonna say was like, you know, what do we do here when we have a decision to make? And like, if those pools of water are drying, the last episode of Frog Week this year, there's like a compilation of stories that didn't make the cut to be like an independent story itself. There was enough content, but like there might have been some context missing or something. So it's almost like the last episode is a compilation of what could have been multiple episodes. And one of those episodes, there's a population of toads that they lost for an entire mile radius. All of the puddles are gone. They dried up. They're not coming back. The habitat is gone. There's one location left, and it was probably the most inconsistent. And so I would go to this pool of water, and as it was starting to dry up, I was bringing 40 gallons of water, dumping it into the pool. And it was like looking at it for the last time. And the reason why I feel like that's important is because if it's the last population, the last breeding site that I could work with this population, does the population completely collapse and go under? Do they travel? It could be a bit of both. What about the spotted salamanders that have site fidelity? There's a lot of like different things. So like if we ask ourselves all of these questions and we really dive deep, we start to understand, you know, a lot of the conservation with wildlife, especially that's native, in my opinion, it's going to be like, it might literally just be you as the only person who cares about that one species or about that one gathering of wood frogs wherever you went, or the one gathering of toads that this is their last puddle that they could breed in, and then if it disappears, they're gone. What do we do with that knowledge? What do we do with that understanding? Like, do we just do nothing and let things happen, or do we get active and try to like make a difference? Do we weigh the options? And so those are open-ended for everybody to kind of ask themselves. But for me, I just feel that sense of responsibility to want to make a difference, to want to be in those trenches, to want to, like, even if I am the only person in the world that cares or that has a chance to make a difference on this one puddle, like, why not go do it? Like, what's that going to hurt if I go and help? So that's kind of the way that I look at things.
Yeah. And I mean, the caveat is, in most conservation efforts of sort, you're going to have active hands in involvement, you know. But yeah, you bring up interesting points to reflect on.
Yeah, I hope some of the listeners, I don't know if we've had any questions come through or not, but I just hope that some of the listeners are going to get some value out of this, because there's so much that they could contribute to, whether they have a family, how they teach their kids, or also what they might be exposed to in their own area where they live, what they could potentially make a difference in. And it's not about getting a video of it and making it go viral. Like, what do you do when the cameras are off? Like, there are things that if I filmed would be probably major hits for Frog Week, but like, either you can't get a camera in that situation, or it's like, you don't even think about a camera. You're just there to make a difference. And I mean, that's like, I want to interact with these animals. Like, once this is over for this week, the field season doesn't technically end. I don't just stop caring about frogs. Like, I'm going to be out there, but I might not be filming them. I might just be going and doing the maintenance or the habitat stuff, or evaluating new populations. So there's so much behind the scenes. It's not just, you know, one and done, like, oh, I'm there from March to July and I'm out. Like, I still go in the wintertime, in the fall. Like, I still go occasionally to visit the habitats and see what's going on. But I just want people to hear that too, because I don't think that's ever been an area where I covered or talked about. So you guys are getting a lot of exclusives here for your podcast.
Well, we appreciate it, Aaron. Did you have anything to touch on, Nate, regarding what we talked about?
Yeah. So I hope that people will take the time to watch Frog Week this year. There's been so much effort that's gone into it, so much sacrifice and discipline. Having to go to bed late, get up early, sacrifices with people that I love and care about, and also sacrifices that I had to make even with work and a lot of things. And I wouldn't do it differently, because this is where I feel like I'm needed the most and where I make an impact. And, you know, it's awesome to bring these stories and these populations that nobody else would have cared about or thought about to your living room or to your phone, and you get a chance to see this and how this matters and what we're trying to accomplish. So the way I look at it, you know, I started off by talking about how I was so motivated and inspired by, like you said, Jeff Corwin, Steve Irwin, David Attenborough, and you know, even the guys like Brave Wilderness and Forrest Galante, like all these guys who are out there in the field, whether they're making a difference or they're just out looking for stuff. They're creating cool stuff to watch. And as a kid growing up, that's really, to me, that's really impressionable. Like, that really stuck with me. I wanted to make a project, especially with having a communication background. You know, when I was a kid, I would have loved to have seen somebody spend 10 minutes or 15 minutes talking about a spring peeper or a wood frog or a bullfrog. Like, why does it get a minute or a couple seconds in passing when we could talk about these animals in depth? There's no reason why we shouldn't. And so I'm making the content that I wish I had when I was a kid. And this generation of kids are going to have a chance to see it. And I'm not necessarily the Pixar Disney-esque presenter either, where if a frog is eating on my channel a caterpillar, or it's eating an ant or whatever, like, I do show that stuff. And there are some hard things that happen. The one thing I haven't shown is roadkill. And that's kind of a debated thing. Should I show it? Should I not show it? Will it drive the point home? Will it cause the kids to like not like? There's a lot. So overall, I just want people to understand, like, in my opinion, and there's been a lot of media coverage on it, this is probably the closest or one of the closest projects you're going to get to seeing like a National Geographic or an Animal Planet-esque documentary style episode about the frogs and toads in our backyards. I have cinema cameras. I have like Netflix approved drones. Like I have weatherproof things. I'm using trail cams. Like I got a legitimate camera fleet to be able to accomplish this. And I hope that people will take it serious, but also want to respond, want to talk about like what it meant for them or reflect on it. And I do hope people on Saturday and Sunday will watch, because the last two episodes I made, the one about my tank that we were talking about, and then the very last episode, you can't miss it. It'll be 40 minutes, but those are the two. If I wanted you to watch, I want you to watch those, because there is so much impact right there. There's so much to take away, but the whole week is special. And I just want to thank you guys for having me on your podcast. I want to thank you for giving me a platform to talk about this and hopefully to encourage or give your listeners something to think about. But again, I'm just so thankful for you guys, and I don't want to be a stranger. I don't want it to be a one and done. So like, you know, if you guys are looking for repeat guests, I'm definitely somebody who would love to join you again. So I just wanted to make that known too.
Oh man, you're too sweet, man. The pleasure is ours for sure. And you know, there's something to be said about the hometown hero, so to speak. You know, I get the sense that as Americans, and maybe Americans who are maybe nature oriented or maybe naturalists, pseudo naturalists, you know, we tend to fixate on things outside, on fauna and flora outside the U.S. Say, you know, Africa, for one example, and nothing wrong with that. You know, we should be charitable and give to those efforts. But what about, you know, what we have around us, or maybe what or lack thereof, you know, in your case, like, you know, we need to, I care about these critters. People should care about them too. And clearly your passion is being driven tonight and it's being shown. So yeah, why not?
Exactly.
A voice for sure. So you're doing the Lord's work, man. I can only see this thing growing and growing.
It's people like you and podcasts like yours that are going to give us a platform to be able to reach people to do it. So, I mean, that's why I'm here.
Awesome. Well, as we are winding down, we do this one tradition with most guests on, disregarding legality or funds. And I'm curious what your answer is going to be. Where would you want to go herp in the world? It could be the U.S. It could be, I mean, anywhere. But where would you want to go herp? What would be your favorite herping destination?
So I can't necessarily, I'll give you the second one, because I'm going to always come back and say it's where I'm at now would be my first, because where I'm at, but I'm not just going to give that. It's not a cop out. It is real, but also like, I'll give you another one. So I also have an Australian vivarium with frogs, like White's tree frogs and bell frogs. And I would love to go out to Australia. I keep saying, once I get married and once we can take a honeymoon, I would love to go, because I actually have a few people I know down there, and I would love to, in the wintertime, our wintertime, their summer, like go and experience their breeding season. Like, can I find a bell frog? Can I find a White Street frog? Like, now what do I do? Because I'm also being hunted. Like, I got to watch out for saltwater crocodiles. Like, that would be, I think people would want to see that. But also at the same time, like, you know, I have a chance to work with the animals where I live. I want to know what they live in Australia and come back home and get to work on building an Australian setup too. I want to make it better. Yeah.
I mean, Australia kind of is like, you know, the twilight zone when it comes to our fauna and flora. It's all topsy turvy. I mean, their kangaroo are like our deer out there. And yeah, the salties would be very interesting. Obviously in the northern and western reaches, but still area. Well, maybe let me get a little more specific. Would you want to go up like in the Northern Territory or Queensland or Western Australia?
I'd like to check out Melbourne, and I'd like to check out of course I'd like to go see the Australia Zoo, but like, yeah, I would like to see the rainforest as well in the north. I want to see like the white-lipped tree frog as well in the forest, because that's such a large frog. And yeah. I'm not the kind of person that fantasizes over having like thousands of animals, but like I could easily see if the bell frogs passed away or something, like that might be another species that would be added into the Australian forest with like my two White's tree frogs potentially. But the white-lipped tree frog is a really special frog, and I'd love to see it. I heard from a guest we had on one of like our podcasts, he lives out there, and he was saying that the white-lipped tree frogs gather around porch lights in Australia, and they eat the invasive geckos. And, like, that's crazy to think.
That is insane, man. I think we may have lost Nate, but no worries. So, yeah, thanks so much, Aaron. This was a blast of an episode. I'm sure people are going to take so much away from it, and we'll shout out all your socials out in the days to come. I am looking forward to Saturday, so that would be a pleasure. And to everyone else, to all the Ramblers, you know, we will catch you in the next one. Bye-bye. Let's see.
Well, Frog Week is out. You can watch it. Woods and Forest Media YouTube channel. I don't know if it's still recording, but if it is, I'll just say it's out now. You don't have to wait till Saturday. First episode dropped on Monday. But guys, thank you so much for being a part of this. Thank you for listening. If your audience is still here, and guys, just drop me a comment in one of the videos if, like, it ended and I'm here talking with you guys. I don't know exactly, but I feel like it is still recording. But yeah, so Frog Week is out now. Frog Week 2025. So please watch it, comment, let me know what your thoughts are. But that's going to do it for me. Nate, I hope that you are feeling well, and I hope that the recording does not go on for a few hours. But if it does, it is what it is. Thank you guys for watching, and hopefully I'll see you again soon. But thank you.